Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. This week on The Connection, a special five-part series on presidential leadership, conflict, and character. Throughout American history, this nation has faced war under the leadership of a handful of presidents, their successes and failures shaping both the presidency and the country. Today we look at the war that posed the greatest threat to the Union and the president whose entire time in office was defined by that threat, Abraham Lincoln. One historian has called him America's most cherished historical possession. But while Lincoln is revered today, his reputation was in dispute for much of his lifetime. As he dealt with the challenges of secession, conscription, slavery, Lincoln altered the very idea of liberty and transformed the meaning of that word for generations to come. He even changed the description of these states united to the United States. Connection listeners, how do you measure the leadership of Abraham Lincoln, and where do you see his influence on America today? Our number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us today, the historian who marked Lincoln as America's cherished historical possession, James McPherson, won the Pulitzer Prize for his History of the Civil War, Battle Cry of Freedom. His biography of the 16th president is called Abraham Lincoln and the Second American Revolution. Jim, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Also this week, the presidential advisor and writer David Gergen is with us. David worked as an advisor to Presidents Nixon, Ford, Reagan, and Clinton. He's a professor of public service at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. His book on presidential leadership is called Eyewitness to Power, The Essence of Leadership. David, welcome back.
I'm honored to be here with Jim McPherson.
Mr. McPherson, why don't we begin in Trenton, New Jersey, as the president-to-be was on his way to Washington, because in a way this links our president today, Lincoln, with George Washington, the man that we spoke about yesterday. Lincoln was quite impressed with Washington.
He certainly was, and he was most impressed, I think, from his childhood when he read the famous hagiography of Washington by Parson Weems. That's the biography that invented the cherry tree story, but also made Washington the father of his country and the great hero of the Revolution. And Lincoln, as a boy, read that book, and when he came to Trenton on his way to Washington to become president of what was already the disunited states in 1861, he told the legislature on the very spot where Washington won the victory in the Battle of Trenton on the day after Christmas 1776 that turned the revolution around, that saved it from collapse, that all his life he had been impressed by the devotion, the dedication of those ragged soldiers with bloody feet and so on who had won that battle. And I think Lincoln took inspiration not only from the leadership of Washington in what up until that time had seemed a hopeless cause, but also from the ideals for which the men had fought, that is to create a union out of 13 separate colonies to give birth to the United States. And Lincoln was determined that his presidency would not see the death of that dream of 1776.
Although it was falling apart even as he made that trip, David.
It was indeed. As soon as he was elected, the southern states started to break off, so that by the time he arrived in Washington for his inaugural, he was under a death threat of his own. As you recall, he had to be snuck into Washington by train at night in order to get there safely. From the very first day, from the moment he took office, he was facing a disunited states. He was facing what he thought was a rebellion that turned into a war, civil war.
Can we go back a little bit, though, to the Lincoln in the years before? Because as we spoke yesterday about Washington's preparation for assuming the presidency, Lincoln seems in many ways to have been singularly unprepared for this job. He'd had some time as a lawyer. He'd had some time in the House of Representatives in the 1840s. But Jim McPherson, he wasn't that prepared for the presidency, was he?
No, he was not prepared for the presidency, nor was he prepared to be commander-in-chief in time of war. He had been a volunteer in the militia during the Black Hawk War of 1832, but as he himself put it in self-deprecation, the only combat he saw was against the mosquitoes. He had served four terms in the Illinois State Legislature in the 1830s and early 1840s, and one term in Congress. He had no administrative experience and no military experience. And so for Lincoln, as president and commander-in-chief, there was indeed a very steep learning curve. One thing that helped him, though, was that all his life, from the time he first ran for the legislature in 1832 at the age of 23 until he became president, he was very much a political animal. He loved politics. He understood politics. He had been not only a candidate for the Senate, but he had also supported other candidates for the Senate. He lived and breathed politics, and his job both as president in time of war and as commander-in-chief was in considerable part a political job. And in that sense, he did have experience and training.
In 1858, before he became president, he was in a Senate race that he lost, but he spoke at that time in a debate, and we'll have a little bit of this courtesy of the actor Sam Waterson from the Ken Burns public television series called The Civil War. This is the words of Abraham Lincoln.
A house divided against itself cannot stand. I believe this government cannot endure permanently half slave and half free. I do not expect the Union to be dissolved. I do not expect the House to fall. But I do expect it will cease to be divided. It will become all one thing or all the other.
David Gergen, for a man who was able to frame words like the mystic chords of memory, that speech is remarkable plain talk, isn't it?
It is remarkable plain talk, but it also employed the use of metaphor in a way that characterized much of Lincoln's language. Jim McPherson has written what I consider one of the best essays on Lincoln on this very subject about the use of metaphor and the use of language and how that distinguished Lincoln. I think in the beginning of the McPherson essay, he points out that by the lights of one historian, if Lincoln had been president of the Confederacy and Jefferson Davis had been president of the Union, the war might have come out the other way, because Davis, even though he was far more educated, did not have the lift and the emotional appeal that a Lincoln did, and that that Lincoln. Part of the remarkable story of Abraham Lincoln, of course, is that he had the least education that I can know of anybody who's ever ascended to the presidency. As he himself said, he had less than 1 year of what was called blab school education. That's when, you know, students from all different grades were in one classroom and they learned their lessons by speaking out loud. And you can imagine the multiplicity of tongues in that environment. But he taught himself. He taught himself by really applying himself through his readings. Parson Weems was an enormously important part of that education, inspiring him with the Washington model, but Aesop's fables, the Bible, Shakespeare. He loved plays, and he loved to read Shakespeare and read Shakespeare out loud. He read pieces of Shakespeare the very day he was assassinated. He was earlier that day. He was reading Shakespeare to friends, and that carried him through, so that he brought to this convention speech, the pieces of which we just heard in 1858 when he was nominated to run against Stephen Douglas for the Senate, a race that then lifted him and nationalized, made him a national figure. He brought to that not only a background as a political animal, as Jim McPherson has said, but he also brought a poetic imagination that was enormously important to his leadership.
Jim, let me hear you on Lincoln and language.
Well, Lincoln could rise to an eloquence unparalleled, I think, by any of our other national leaders. In addition to Shakespeare and Aesop's fables, he also learned to read by reading the Bible. And indeed, the image of the house divided comes from the Bible. It is quoting Jesus, actually, from the book of Mark. And many of Lincoln's rhythms of speech, patterns of speech, allusions in his speech, and sometimes even the content of the speech were drawn from the Bible and from biblical images. And I think that's one reason why he was so effective in communicating with the common people. in a way that very few other leaders have been, because Americans in the mid-19th century, many of them had also been brought up on the Bible. They recognized its images. The parables in the Bible, in the New Testament, are a form of extended metaphor. When Jesus tells a parable, he's making a point about something different from the literal nature of that story. And that's exactly what a metaphor is. And I think one of Lincoln's great abilities was to use these often very homey, down-to-earth metaphors to present an image to his audience, whether it be an audience listening to him or reading him, that immediately enabled them to understand a fairly complex point, because he was able to frame it in a simple manner and present it as a metaphor or a parable.
David, help us with how he turned this to his advantage as a leader, because similar to Washington, Lincoln was somewhat remote. He didn't have a lot of friends, or he didn't make a lot of speeches. He did a lot of writing. But how did he exploit this talent that Jim's describing as a leader?
Well, actually, he gave very few speeches as president. And the ones he gave, for the most part, were extremely memorable. But before he came to the presidency, he rose into prominence through his capacity to speak. He gave an enormous number of speeches. After he came back from, he spent this one term in Congress in the late 1840s, came back after that one term, thought he was finished in politics, essentially went into the wilderness politically, and was discouraged about his future prospects in life, wrote to his law partner, one of his friends, that he was just worried he was never going to make a mark in life. And he polished his legal skills, but was on the sidelines. And it was then the repeal of the Missouri Compromise in 1854 that, by all accounts, and Jeff McPherson can speak to this much more eloquently than I can, that really drew him back in. And what the repeal of the Missouri Compromise did was to open the door to slavery spreading into the new territories. And Lincoln thought that slavery was a dying institution and would eventually pass from the scene. But by going into the territories, he was terribly worried, no, indeed, it's going to spread. And that's why he gave the House Divided speech and spoke of it in those terms. But Lincoln made an enormous number of speeches, hundreds of speeches, from 1854 until the time he was elected. And his speeches, the Lincoln-Douglas debates, as well as the House Divided speech, and then particularly a speech at Cooper Union in New York on the eve of the 1860 campaign, made him a national figure. So his capacity to speak on his feet, to speak extemporaneously, as well as from a prepared notes, which he didn't do very often, and to use these metaphors to explain to take a complex world and turn it into something that people could relate to, to use metaphors that related to nature, that related to the Bible, that related to people who were essentially still a rural people.
The wolf, the black sheep.
Oh, there's a wonderful, like, yeah, to use that metaphor. We'll come back to that.
Yeah, we'll have to talk about it when we get back. And we will talk more about Lincoln as a wartime leader, because this is part of what we're doing. This week is looking at presidents in times of crisis. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Abraham Lincoln, this hour, why does he rank as one of the country's greatest presidents? I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston NPR News Station.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. And these are the words of Abraham Lincoln, just 270 of them, spoken on a battlefield in Pennsylvania.
67 years ago, our fathers brought forth upon this continent a new nation, conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Now we are engaged in a great civil war, testing whether that nation or any nation so conceived and so dedicated can long endure. We are met here on a great battlefield of that war. We have come to dedicate a portion of it as a final resting place for those who here gave their lives that their nation might live. It is altogether fitting and proper that we should do this. But in a larger sense, we cannot dedicate, we cannot consecrate, we cannot hallow this ground. The brave men, living and dead, who struggled here have consecrated it far above our poor power to add or detract. The world will little note nor long remember what we say here, but can never forget what they did here. It is for us, the living, rather to be dedicated here to the unfinished work which they have thus far so nobly carried on. It is rather for us to be here dedicated to the great task remaining before us, that from these honored dead we take increased devotion to that cause for which they here gave the last full measure of devotion. That we here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain. That this nation, under God, shall have a new birth of freedom. And that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth.
That's the Gettysburg Address, delivered by Abraham Lincoln, November 19th, 1863. The reading by actor Sam Waterson. It's from the Ken Burns public television series called The Civil War. Well, we know that that series and the writing of our guest Jim McPherson helped spark a renewed interest in the Civil War. We're talking with him and former presidential advisor David Gergen about presidential leadership in a time of war. Jim McPherson, what is it about the Gettysburg Address that you think marks that man as a leader?
Well, in just 270 words, he eloquently expressed the meaning of the war, the meaning of the suffering and the death, the dedication of the soldiers and what they were fighting for. They were fighting to preserve the nation created by that generation of 1776, which, by the way, the generation of the Civil War would certainly have said was America's greatest generation. They look back on that generation as a race of giants, and the question was whether the Americans or those who supported the Union in 1863 was worthy of the legacy of that generation. This Civil War, Lincoln said, was the great test of whether the nation they had founded on the ideals they had expressed in the Declaration of Independence would survive or would be swept into the dustbin of history. And the victory at Gettysburg was a giant step toward its survival, but also, as Lincoln said in the Gettysburg Address, toward giving that nation a new birth of freedom, because the great deficiency in the legacy from the Founding Fathers was the institution of slavery, which had driven the country apart in 1861 and was destroying the old Union established by those Founding Fathers, but giving the generation of the 1860s, as Lincoln expressed it at Gettysburg, an opportunity to recreate that nation and give it a new birth of freedom. And I think anybody who any leader who can express all of those complex ideas in 270 words that everyone can understand, clearly that's a mark of tremendous leadership.
Jim McPherson, as he always is, as I write about this, let me add just a couple of points. As a speech, as a form of, it's so often said that we govern in prose, not poetry. This is poetry. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the structure of the speech, it starts out with the past, then moves to the present, and then moves to the future, which Lincoln often did in his speeches. But there's something deeper going on here. In the first lines, our fathers brought forth, conceived, created. Those are the words of birth. And then he talks about death on the battlefield. And then he talks about rebirth. This speech is about the rebirth of the nation, and from death comes rebirth. Lincoln was not only about metaphors, he was about the deeper polarities in human existence, and that when there is, and that from death can come rebirth. That's very important. But he's also linking it up to this idea of freedom and equality, which is very important. Gary Wills argues in his book on the Gettysburg Address that many up until Lincoln's time had dated the beginning of the Republic to the Constitution, to 1787. Lincoln is saying in this, no, 67 years ago, our fathers brought forth. He's dating the beginning of the Republic to 1776, and then talking about a rebirth of freedom now. Well, what's important about the Declaration, of course, is it has equality in it. The word equality is not in the Constitution. Lincoln has gone back to resurrect the Declaration as the central document, the founding document, not the Constitution, but the Declaration, as the founding document of the country, and given equality a central place in the pantheon of American values. Up until that time, there had been enormous emphasis placed on liberty. Lincoln is saying it's liberty and equality. And that's why he's not only giving meaning to the war, but he's giving meaning to the national experience and what the future of the nation should be. That's leadership.
Jim McPherson, there is some aspect of the man's character that we haven't talked about, and that is his adaptability. He went into this war to save the Union, not to free the slaves. He brought out the Emancipation Proclamation in as much as a political document, as a moral document. He seemed to be able to shift and move and adapt in ways that are really quite admirable.
Well, I think that the quality of Lincoln's leadership was his inflexibility in the support of the central principle for which he thought the country stood, which was union, and his flexibility or his adaptability in the means to achieve that end, that principle. And throughout the war, he repeatedly said that most directly and clearly in his famous letter to New York Tribune editor Horace Greeley in August 1862, who had written an editorial called The Prayer of 20 Millions, urging Lincoln to declare emancipation. Lincoln said that his central goal in this war was to preserve the Union, and whatever he did about slavery was in the service of achieving that goal. Whether he freed some, all, or none of the slaves, it was in the service of preserving the Union. Now, at the time he said this, that he wrote this public letter to Greeley, he had already made a decision to issue the Emancipation Proclamation, and he was paving the way for public acceptance of that by insisting to people in the North who opposed emancipation that it might become necessary in order to achieve the goal that they supported, which was union. And I think that's an outstanding example of the way in which Lincoln would combine a kind of inflexibility, or at least determination to uphold a central principle, but a great deal of flexibility in the means to achieve that. Now, that doesn't mean that Lincoln saw emancipation only as an instrument, only as a means. He had said many times back in the 1850s, and he said it again in that letter to Greeley, that slavery was a great evil. At one occasion, he called it a monstrous injustice. So he was also dedicated to the new birth of freedom that he proclaimed at Gettysburg, but he also felt that not everybody in the North believed that, and therefore he would emphasize the central principle that united the Northern people, which was union, and make the issue that divided them, emancipation, subordinate to it, even though in his own mind, I think he saw these as co-equal goals. And by the last year or so of the war, when he ran for re-election in 1864 on a platform endorsing the 13th Amendment to the Constitution to end slavery forever, he had united these two goals. He had foreshadowed that in the Gettysburg Address, when he said not only were we preserving the nation founded in 1776, but we were giving it a new birth of freedom. By the last 2 years of the war, he had brought these two things together in a single overriding goal to preserve the nation, but also to give it a new birth of freedom.
We'll talk a bit more about that. I do want to, though, bring some of our callers in who've been waiting on the line. William's in Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, William.
Hello.
Thanks for calling.
Sure. I just wanted to say that I was struck. I remember visiting the Lincoln Memorial and being able to read the second inaugural. And the thing that really strikes me about Lincoln, and I also, I think I read Gore Vidal's Lincoln quite a while ago, but it seems he was so humble, and especially in the second inaugural, he expressed a kind of humility that I don't think you could fake. You know, it was very genuine, and it's really striking when you think about the bitterness of that time and, you know, the loss that he'd already experienced. And it's just remarkable to me, and it's a quality I don't think I've seen in any other president to the depth that he seemed to have it.
Let's listen to just a few of those words that William's talking about.
With malice towards none, with charity for all, with firmness in the right as God gives us to see the right, let us strive on to finish the work we are in, to bind up the nation's wounds, to care for him who shall have borne the battle and for his widow and his orphan, to do all which may achieve and cherish a just and lasting peace among ourselves and with all nations.
David Kirkin.
Well, the second inaugural, some believe, is an even greater speech than the Gettysburg Address. I'm sure a lively debate that Jim could tell us about among historians on that, but it was it's a more complex speech. It comes after the Gettysburg Address, comes in 1865. Of course, Gettysburg was 1863. But it has the same pattern of past, present, future. The words we just heard are from the last paragraph talking about the future. But it's much more cast in theological terms. The Gettysburg Address is about our secular documents, about the Declaration of Independence. The second inaugural, he invokes God and the Bible on many occasions, at least four or five times. He quotes from the Bible, and Lincoln, I'm not sure whether he has become religious, because he was not particularly religious as such before he became president. But he invokes God and religion in such a way that this is almost a theological statement. And it, again, is about it. There's a piece in there earlier when he says, in talking about the South and the North, they both read the same Bible and pray to the same God, and each invokes his aid against the other. And he says, it's strange, each of us who, you know, prays to the same God might be fighting each other. He said, but let us judge not that we be not judged. Right from the Sermon on the Mount. And what he is talking about is a rebirth of the nation that is in a virtuous or almost theological framework, that he's appealing to the nation, to the better angels and people's conscience about how they would live together when the war is over. And it's a very positive statement about binding up the wounds after it's over that the nation did not follow. But it was Lincoln's path into the future. And it was one of the great tragedies for the country that he was cut down and was not able to see the country, move the country, lead the country in that direction.
Jim McPherson, tell me whether or not you think that some of the religious language that comes in that David's describing was in part a result of the awful war that he had led the country through. Some 630,000 men died in the country. I think, that this would have come, you know, only months after his decision that he's going to have to allow Sherman to do the awful march to the sea. This man, for all the praise that he gets, had an enormous amount of blood on his hands.
There's no doubt about that, and I think that did make him more religious, more questing to try to understand God's purpose in this war. I think another dimension of the second inaugural is the culmination of Lincoln's questioning during the course of the war why so much bloodshed had fallen on the United States. Why would God allow this? He had asked that question in private private jottings that he had written at various times during the war. And the second inaugural becomes a kind of meditation on God's will. Not only did he say, as David Gergen quoted, that both sides pray to the same God, And both invoke his aid. He said both cannot be right, that God is on their side. And then he said maybe neither is right. Maybe God has his own purpose in this war. And God controls human destiny. And then he suggests that that God's purpose in this war may be to cleanse America of the great sin of slavery. He did not use the word sin, but clearly that was the point he was making. And that if every drop drawn by the sword if every drop drawn by the lash of slavery, the whip of slavery, must be paid by drops of blood drawn by the sword, so be it. That's God's will in this war. And I think this is Lincoln's attempt to understand theologically, but also at a personal psychological level, because he was the commander-in-chief who had sent into action these soldiers who had died. His attempt to understand just why this had happened, and he reflects on the inscrutable will of God and said maybe this is the reason.
David, let me hear from you briefly on this.
One can certainly take instruction from this in our own day, that Lincoln looked at this and shirked and drew back from the notion that God is on our side. He said God is on neither side, and we have to understand that. He was not cheerleading by saying God is on our side, and it's something that we would do well to remember today.
We'll talk a little bit about Lincoln in office when we get a chance to come back after the break. Here's a man who prosecuted the war by going to the Library of Congress and getting out books on it so he could stay abreast of his generals, and leaving much of the administration to his rivals in his cabinet and paying virtually no attention at all to foreign affairs while he was so caught up in the Civil War. Connection listeners, our number is 1-800-423-8255. We invite you in to talk about Abraham Lincoln in this, our series on presidents in times of crisis, conflict, and character. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Funding for The Connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Coming up on Here and Now at noon...
You're listening to The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. Our number is 1-800-423-8255 to talk about Abraham Lincoln this hour. And with me on the program, Jim McPherson, professor of American history at Princeton University, winner of the Pulitzer Prize for his history, Battle Cry of Freedom, also author of other books, a collection of essays, Abraham Lincoln and the Second American Revolution. I've got that right, do I, Jim? It's not a biography, but a collection
right.
of essays?
It is a collection of essays.
Mm-hmm. And our listeners will remember you were here earlier talking about Crossroads of Freedom, the Battle of Antietam. David Gergen's in the studio with me. He's a professor of public service at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard, former advisor to Nixon and Ford and Reagan and Clinton, and to a lesser extent to Bush and who have I left off? Carter. Took a little bit of advice from you.
Forgot Chester Arthur.
If you want to claim that. I do want to speak, not for a long period of time, because there's so many big issues here that need to be dealt with, but as an administrator, as a leader, he couldn't just completely concentrate on the war without putting other things in place in a way that freed him up to do that. Was that a skill, David, that he brought to that?
Well, he brought together a very strong cabinet. Like Washington, he reached out to people of enormous talent, and he also ensured that they represented different parts of the country, because he was elected as a minority candidate. One can't ignore how important it was to Lincoln that the election of 1860 brought a split in the Democratic Party, and then another candidate, so with three other candidates, Lincoln comes in the fourth candidate. The way he became president was because the Democratic Party basically broke up, and he was elected with like 43% of the vote. It may have been 40%, but it was a much less than one needs to govern well. So he was right from the beginning a minority president, and then of course states broke away from him. But 40% of the people who were in the union side had voted Democratic. They voted the other way. So he had to be extraordinarily skillful in bringing people along, pay very sensitive attention to public opinion, not get too far out in front of the public, and to let events take their course and then take advantage of them. And so that he came under a lot of criticism. And about the only way he could manage that was to shuffle off some of the issues, a lot of the domestic agenda. He not only left his cabinet, more importantly, left it to the Congress. He didn't. He basically thought that Congress ought to run the domestic show, and there was a lot of important legislation passed during his time as president, but he didn't have much to do with it. He basically signed it. It wasn't like a modern president sending up the agenda and that sort of thing. And then, of course, he's a very human person who had his hands full with problems at home, with a wife who was mercurial, but to say it charitably. Some people thought she was nuts, but she was a colorful figure, a most colorful figure we've had since Dolly Madison. The tragic loss of a son and his frequent bouts of depression that he had to work through. They were not as black as some of the periods he'd had before he became president. I think this is a man who was totally absorbed with the war and had to let much of the rest of the country be run by others.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Washington, North Carolina. Ray's joining us. Hello, Ray.
Hello, how are you?
Fine, thanks for calling.
Thank you. I had a question, I guess, would be titled more towards regards of policy. Being from the South, born and raised in Washington, North Carolina, our town, like many others along the southern East Coast, were completely devastated during the time of the Civil War. A lot of our town in particular was burned twice and completely devastated a lot of our historical structures and stuff. Mm-hmm. Now we have no more than just a plaque to remind us of those structures that once stood. And I'd like to ask the question of your guest, I guess, number one, was President Lincoln have been informed on the goings-on that were happening in the South, and would he have approved? I would think not, being the great man he was, but I'd like to hear their opinion on that.
Great question, Ray. Thanks. Jim, I'll put that one over to you.
Lincoln would not have approved of the wanton destruction of civilian property that had no connection with the Confederate war effort. But by 1864, when Sherman marched through Georgia, and 1865 when he marched through South Carolina and up into North Carolina, he certainly approved of the complete destruction of any resources in the South that could be used to support the Confederate war effort, whether it be railroads or factories or merely the food and fiber grown on the farms. Because by that time, the Civil War had become what some historians call a total war, others call a hard war. The idea was no longer to conciliate the Southern white people, because that approach had been tried in 1861 and even into 1862, at a time when Lincoln's idea about this war was to suppress a rebellion carried out by certain leaders in the South without touching the property of most civilians in the South. That hadn't worked. And the abolition of slavery, or the emancipation of the slaves in the Emancipation Proclamation and in legislation by Congress, was the first step toward confiscating, attacking, destroying any Southern property that was used to wage war against the United States. And in the process of doing that, there's going to be an awful lot of what we now call collateral destruction. Well, that was true in the Civil War. It did not result in the loss of life, but it certainly resulted in the loss of a lot of property in the South that had no direct connection with the war effort, but could, I suppose, be called collateral damage.
All right. Thanks for that. And, Ray, thanks for your call, 1-800-423-8255, to Buffalo, New York now. And David's joining us. Hi, David.
Hello. Question I had was if someone could comment on what I'm catching on some of the Internet sites these days about revisionist history, Southern Party, for instance, talking about Abraham Lincoln being nothing more than a corporate lawyer, and that the Civil War was fought over tariffs rather than any other higher goal.
Well, he certainly made some dramatic changes in the economy of the country. David. But Jim McPherson, is it fair to say that as David's reading, he had set aside everything, was acting as a lawyer in the corporate interests?
Well, Lincoln was a lawyer who occasionally represented corporations, particularly railroads, and in one case, the McCormick Farm Machinery Company. But it would be a caricature to call him a corporate lawyer. In his law practice in Springfield, he took all kinds of cases from farmers who charged that the railroads had killed their livestock, local cases of theft or of extortion, any number of cases. And I would say out of the thousands of cases, and there's been a lot of study of Lincoln's legal cases in the recent years, out of the 1,000 cases that he handled during his career as a lawyer, a career that spanned about 23 years, only a tiny percentage, certainly no more than 3 or 4%, were in defense of corporations. And as far as the idea that slavery, that the tariff caused the war, nothing could be more absurd.
And to add to that, Lincoln had grown up politically as a Whig, and it was a party. And one of his great heroes was Henry Clay. It was a party that did believe that the government ought to engage in internal improvements and ideas that went all the way back to Alexander Hamilton, and that there was a party that did believe in high tariffs in order to allow manufacturing industry to grow in the country, to give it some shelter. But I think it's a misreading of history to say that that's what moved Lincoln. He came back into politics, as we said, in the mid 1850s on the issues of slavery and the extension of slavery, not on economic issues. Much of his earlier political life had been devoted to economic issues, and slavery had not been uppermost. But when he disappeared for a while, he went into the wilderness. But when he came back, the centrality, the gravity of his argument had to do with the extension of slavery.
There's also the way that he changed the use of the word liberty, because Jim McPherson, going into the Civil War, liberty meant the liberty to own slaves. And this president dramatically changed that.
He changed the concept of liberty in that respect, certainly. And I think he changed it in a broader sense as well. Liberty, as it had been understood up until the Civil War, was always threatened by power. The power of a king, the power of concentrated wealth, the power of dictatorial government. And so liberty was set in opposition to power, and that meant that, as Thomas Jefferson said, the best government is the government that governs least, because if government governs too much, it threatens liberty. And, of course, Southern slaveholders had used that concept of liberty to defend the institution of slavery against any interference by the national government or any other concentration of power. That's where the connection between states' rights and slavery and, indeed, liberty, the liberty to own slaves without interference by the government, and the liberty to take them into the territories. And the federal government can't prevent you from doing that. That was the concept of liberty that underlay secession, that underlay the attitude of many Americans toward liberty. Lincoln transformed that because he used the immense power of the government and, indeed, of the United States Army to bring an end to slavery. And in a famous speech in 1864, Lincoln said that we all believe in liberty, but we don't all mean the same thing by it. And then he used another one of these wonderful metaphors for the black sheep. Liberty is to be safe from being eaten by the wolf, but to the wolf, and by that he meant the slave owner, to protect the sheep from the wolf was a deprivation of the wolf's liberty. And of course, Lincoln was putting himself in the character of the shepherd who was protecting the sheep from the wolf, the slave owner, in that particular speech. And it's one of the most wonderful uses of metaphor, but also one of the best expressions of the way in which the war transformed liberty from what is often called, what I've called and others have called, negative liberty, that is freedom from interference by the government in doing whatever you want to do, into a concept of positive liberty, freedom to become to improve yourself, to move up on the social and economic ladder, to achieve the freedom freedom from slavery.
David, is there a simple way to assess the historical contribution to the office of the presidency of President Lincoln, specifically if we think about him as a leader in wartime, as a man who developed his character and the character of this country in a time of crisis?
Well, there's no simple way. Lincoln clearly expanded the office of the presidency a great deal. But then it snapped back after he left office. As you know, the original constitutional conception was that Congress was in Article I, the presidency was in Article II, Congress would be the dominant branch. And Lincoln was one of the exceptions in our early history of someone who became the dominant figure in government. And people saw how the power could be exercised, but he intended it to be emergency power. As commander-in-chief, he was expanding his powers. When the Emancipation Proclamation, he justified as a commander-in-chief. When he suspended habeas corpus, he justified that as commander-in-chief. These were all intended to secure the Union, and when it was over, then those powers would recede. After Lincoln left office for a fairly long time, no one was that powerful. But his successors in the 20th century, starting with Teddy Roosevelt and others, would go back to Lincoln in the way he exercised power. Teddy Roosevelt said, if it's not forbidden in the Constitution, it means you do have the power. You have the inherent power as president. And he wanted to expand the power. Teddy Roosevelt was not only admiring of Lincoln, but he was jealous. he would love to have been president while Lincoln was there, because he thought a great war made a great president, and that he could have been as immortal as Lincoln. But I think that's not the real point, the expansion of power, although that's significant. The real point is the nobility he brought to the office, the model he left behind, the sense of the president as leader appealing to the better nature, angels in our nature. James McGregor Burns writes about the distinguishes between what he calls transactional leadership versus transformational leadership. The transactional leader is the one we see so much of. It's somebody who says to us, you know, if you give me your vote, I will build you a bridge. If you give me your vote, I will provide you with a farm subsidy. That's a transaction. But transformational leader is one who takes us to a higher way of living. And that's what Lincoln did as president.
David, thanks so much. Again, David Gergen, professor of public service and director of the Center for Public Leadership at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. Jim McPherson, thanks for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Mr. McPherson is professor of history at Princeton University. And Connection listeners, our series on conflict and character continues tomorrow with Woodrow Wilson. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. To purchase cassettes and CDs of The Connection, please visit www.theconnection.org or phone 1-800-909-9287.
This is WBUR.